This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks for listening. This weekend has heard the ringing of bells. Bells tolling for the loss of someone for whom no one needed a reminder. Ali. The bells tolled for thee. Bells in the ring. All the bells he answered in the ring.
31-year-old Sonny Liston, 22-year-old Cassius Clay.
It is a seventh-round knockout.
It's recorded as the seventh-round knockout.
All the bells he didn't answer.
My intention is to box to win a clean fight. But in war, the intention is to kill, and continue killing innocent people.
The passing of Muhammad Ali, Cassius Clay, has been commemorated over the past few days, a life remembered. But on this Monday, as the world picks up and moves on, we want to note that this was a man who predicted and then created his own legend.
I am the greatest. This is the legend of Cassius Clay, the most beautiful fighter in the world today. He talks a great deal in rags and deedy of a muscular punch that's incredibly speedy. This brash young boxer is something to see, and the heavyweight championship is his destiny. He is the greatest.
His 1964 album, I Am the Greatest, produced in the same year he became the champ. And as heavyweight champion of the world, he then faced down the United States of America and its war machine in Vietnam.
My conscience won't let me go shoot my brother or some darker people or some poor hungry people in the mud. For big, powerful America, and shoot them for what? They never called me nigger. They never lynched me. They never put no dogs on me. They never robbed me of my nationality, raped and killed my mother and father. Well, I'm going to shoot them for what? How am I going to shoot them? Them little poor little black people, little babies and children and women. How can I shoot them poor people? Just take me to jail.
He anticipated that the Vietnam War was a military and moral mistake.
There have been many questions put to me why I refuse to be inducted into the United States Army, especially as some have pointed out, many have pointed out, when not taking the step, I will lose so much. And I would like to say to those of the press and those of the people who think that I lost so much by not taking the step, I would like to say that I did not lose a thing. Up until this very moment, I haven't lost one thing. I have gained a lot. Number one, I have gained a peace of mind. I have gained a peace of heart.
After a suspension from boxing, from refusing the draft, when he had been virtually promised he would be kept out of harm's way, he was vindicated by the U.S. Supreme Court for refusing that draft. As a conscientious objector, he became Muhammad Ali and made the world recognize it. Here he makes fighter Ernie Terrell recognize it.
Cassius Clay, yes.
Why do you want to say Cassius Clay when Howard Cosell and everybody is calling you Muhammad Ali? Now why you got to be the one of all people who's color to keep saying Cassius Clay?
Howard Cosell is not the one who's going to fight you. I am.
You're making it really hard on yourself now. Why don't you keep the thing in the sport angle? Why don't you call me my name, man?
Well, what's your name? You told me your name was Cassius Clay a few years ago.
I never told you my name was Cassius Clay. My name is Muhammad Ali, and you will announce it right there in the center of that ring after the fight if you don't do it now.
Ali made good on all of his brags. Boxing for him was the way to show that he would be no white man's Negro. This grandson of a slave always had some deeper strength to draw on. Ali fought his way back, the most arduous path back to the heavyweight championship in the 1970s. In his three fights with Joe Frazier, two with George Foreman, all classics, Ali took a measure of punishment deemed fatal to nearly anyone else. For Ali, winning was not the point. The fight was outside the ring.
England is heaven compared to America. In America, last weekend in Chicago, 12 people died fighting each other. A week before that, 24 died. They all happened to be my people, black people.
As he slipped into the silence of Parkinson's disease in his 40s, his legend only deepened. But it was hard to watch and harder to understand.
Does it bother you when you hear people say, as they do, Muhammad Ali's punch drunk?
No. I didn't drink that much.
Does it bother you when people say,
no.
you know, you should have gotten out earlier, you're
no,
sick as
no.
a result of the punches?
No, if I felt if I did, I wouldn't come on the show.
You wouldn't come on here?
No, because I'd be worried about what you were asking.
In the end, Ali's moral authority put him on the same stage as people like Nelson Mandela, yet for Ali to get the world's attention required him only to show up. He did not have to speak a word. It was as if all the words he had spoken before, the brags and hyperbole, would echo for him when he could no longer speak.
And I'm going to bring back the excitement in boxing. I'm going to be the heavyweight champion of the world. And I won't be satisfied with that. After becoming champion of the world, I'm going to become champion of the universe.
Boxing was nothing, Ali once said. It wasn't important at all. Boxing was just meant as a way to introduce me to the world.
It will be a killer and a chiller and a thriller when I get the gorilla in Manila.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is Cassius Marcellus Clay. He's young, he's handsome.
They know it.
I can pound a drink of water and kill a dead tree. Don't miss it, Muhammad Ali.
The tragedy of Parkinson's disease was always seen as a consequence of boxing for Ali. It was perhaps the one thing he did not predict about himself, how he would be silenced and still grow in stature, even becoming a symbol of the struggle to treat Parkinson's. Joining me now is Ulla Isaacson, professor of neurology at Harvard University. Welcome.
Thank you.
Can you assess the impact of Muhammad Ali's stature in the world and his sort of visibility as someone who suffered from Parkinson's disease as having changing the way in which doctors and medical professionals approached Parkinson's?
I hope so. I had the privilege of meeting Muhammad Ali on a couple of occasions. We spoke together actually at a congressional hearing for health and labor, you know, medicine and research, along with Michael J. Fox. And I was struck, like so many other people, obviously, what a strength and spirit that Muhammad Ali exudes. Even when he didn't move, you could really feel his presence and humor, most of all. And so I really hope that people do pay attention. We tend to get sort of a singular message, I think, about head trauma, for example, or that it's one thing or another, genetics being very important, of course. But I hope that people realize that this kind of injury that he had, in his case, led to very severe brain damage. And thankfully, he stayed with us for such a long time after his injury. You know, he was 40 when he got the disease. And typically, if you just do pure genetics, you say, well, that must be genetic because those are the early cases. But as I mentioned earlier, if you have bad luck and a coincidence of bad outcomes, then you could get early Parkinson's disease without much genetics. But then again, we never really know. And unless there is an autopsy of Mr. Ali's brain, we won't know exactly perhaps what additional damage he would have had.
Where do we stand on Parkinson's? And on the one hand, there's the cause issue. Did boxing cause Ali's Parkinson's and others? And then there's the question of treatment. Where do we stand on the treatment of Parkinson's caused by the kind of physical trauma that people like Muhammad Ali have experienced?
Well, you know, the treatment of Parkinson's disease has remained the same for roughly 40 years, the principle being that when you get Parkinson's disease, you lose a cell in the midbrain. We start off with about a million so-called dopamine neurons. And when you lost about 70% of those, you will have this lack of movement and tremor. So the treatment is to elevate dopamine levels artificially in the brain by drugs. But apart from that, not much has arrived. Much of the treatments are actually trying to prevent the side effects of these drugs. So you actually see, for example, in Michael J. Fox, that he has extra movements, and those come from too much dopamine. But on the horizon is better drugs, but also an understanding that we need to reconnect the brain. And for example, we've been working on implantation of new dopamine neurons from stem cells, and we hope that that one day will restore function better than the current drugs.
What about our understanding of the kinds of damage that could be caused from boxing and other physical traumas to the brain, including the kinds of things we're seeing in Iraq and Afghanistan?
Well, the tragedy, you know, for people like Muhammad Ali, but also people who are experiencing severe blows to the head, is that, you know, the brain is like a squishy ball inside your head. And when you get hit by something really hard, this ball kind of squishes against the skull. And What happens in the next few days is that you get brain inflammation. And that's not so different than the inflammation you have in other tissues. And in other words, the organ actually looks a little bit red and bruised. And during the next 2 to 3 weeks after such an injury, you can imagine that the cells actually are quite vulnerable to a second injury, or what we call double hit. And in fact, our modeling systems in animals show you that not just getting hit in the head for killing dopamine neurons, but also, as you know, the concussions and severe blows you get in the head, for example, in football or ice hockey, are quite equivalent to a very severe blow to the head. And the outcome could be, for example, Parkinson's disease, but also not infrequently the kind of brain damage you see with football players, but also, originally it was called punch drunk syndrome. Boxers would develop a kind of dementia over time. So probably more likely that you get the Alzheimer-like version than Parkinson's disease. But nevertheless, it's quite clear statistically that if you have one severe loss of consciousness, the risk for Parkinson's disease can increase by about 50%. And you can imagine that if you have bad luck and have something else going on that could create inflammation, or you have a genetic predisposition, these factors combined will then increase the risk of getting Parkinson's. By the way, we all probably get some form of Parkinson's by the age of 100 and so. So the strongest risk factor is really age.
Professor of Neurology at Harvard University, Uli Isaacson, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Just throwing punches. Damn, damn. That's bad to do that, and you're not hurting the man. Psychologically, you're not hurting him. And all the time I was talking, tiring yourself out, George. Keep going. Come take another shot.
From Louisville, Kentucky, name of Cassius Clay.
Be ready to fight.
Fought my way out to see another day.
He might be great, but he'll fall apart.
Against old son enlisted. Took my title from it, but I kept on my mission.
I don't like fighters' culture.
Flow like a butterfly.
Your face is in trouble.
Flow like a butterfly. Stand like a bee.
I'm ready to back up everything I'm saying.
Know you got me dancing. I'm a champion of the ring. Know my name is Muhammad Ali.
They say that actually, every time that I enter the ring, in a way, I'm going to walk. My intention is to box to win a clean fight. But in war, the intention is to kill, 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 and continue killing innocent people. That's what the business is about. I would like to hear this from you, and I want the world and the cameras to hear. Who's the heavyweight champion of the world?
Flow like a butterfly, sting like a bee. Flow like a butterfly.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at the New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.